You look like a squaddy.
No problem, said Barclay. I'll be the poor wee laddie who didn't know what he was getting himself into. Hard left his love, that shite. Let him patronise me.
Grinning, Strike took out his cigarettes. For all his initial doubts, he was starting to think that Barclay might have been a good hire.
All right, hang fire till you hear from me again. Should be sometime Sunday.
As Strike rang off, Lorelei appeared with a glass of red for him.
Want some help in the kitchen?
Strike asked, though without moving.
No, stay there, I won't be long,
she replied, smiling. He liked her 50s style apron. As she returned to the kitchen, he lit up. Although Lorelei did not smoke, she had no objection to Strike's Benson and Hedges as long as he used the kitsch ashtray decorated with cavorting poodles that she had provided for the purpose. Smoking, he admitted to himself that he envied Barclay Infiltrating Night and his band of hard-left colleagues. It was the kind of job Strike had relished in the military police. He remembered the four soldiers in Germany who had become enamoured of a local far-right group. Strike had managed to persuade them that he shared their belief in a white ethno-nationalist superstate, infiltrated a meeting, and secured four arrests and prosecutions that had given him particular satisfaction. Turning on the TV, he watched Channel 4 News for a while, drinking his wine, smoking in pleasurable anticipation of pad thai and other sensual delights, and for once enjoying what so many of his fellow workers took for granted, but which he had rarely experienced, the relief and release of a Friday night. Strike and Lorelei had met at Eric Wardle's birthday party. It had been an awkward evening in some ways, because Strike had seen Coco there for the first time since telling her by phone that he had no interest in another date. Coco had got very drunk. At one in the morning, while he was sitting on a sofa deep in conversation with Lorelei, she had marched across the room, thrown a glass of wine over both of them, and stormed off into the night. Strike had not been aware that Coco and Lorelei were old friends until the morning after he woke up in Lorelei's bed. He considered that this was really more Lorelei's problem than his. She seemed to think the exchange, for Coco wanted nothing more to do with her, more than fair.
"How'd you do it?" Wardle had asked, the next time they met, genuinely puzzled. "Blimey, I'd like to know your—"
Strike raised his heavy eyebrows, and Wardle appeared to gag on what had come perilously close to a compliment.
"There is no secret," said Strike. "Some women just like fat, one-legged, pube-headed men with broken noses."
"Well, it's a sad indictment of our mental health services that they're loose on the streets," Wardle had said, and Strike had laughed. Lorelei was her real name, taken not from the mythical siren of the Rhine, but from Marilyn Monroe's character in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, her mother's favourite film. Men's eyes swiveled when she passed them in the street, but she evoked neither the profound longing nor the searing pain that Charlotte had caused Strike. Whether this was because Charlotte had stunted his capacity to feel so intensely, or because Lorelei lacked some essential magic, he did not know. Neither Strike nor Lorelei had said, "I love you." In Strike's case, this was because, desirable and amusing though he found her, he could not have said it honestly. It was convenient to him to assume that Lorelei felt the same way. She had recently ended a 5-year-long live-in relationship when, after several lingering looks across Wardle's dark sitting room, he had strolled across to talk to her. He had wanted to believe her when she had told him how glorious it was to have her flat to herself and her freedom restored. Yet lately, he had felt tiny spots of displeasure when he had told her he had to work weekends, like the first heavy drops of rain that presage a storm. She denied it when challenged. "No, no, of course not, if you've got to work." But Strike had set out his uncompromising terms at the outset of the relationship. His work was unpredictable and his finances poor. Hers was the only bed he intended to visit, but if she sought predictability or permanence, he was not the man for her. She had appeared content with the deal, and if, over the course of 10 months, she had grown less so,
Strike was ready to call things off with no hard feelings. Perhaps she sensed this, because she had forced no argument. This pleased him, and not merely because he could do without the aggravation. He liked Lorelei, enjoyed sleeping with her, and found it desirable, for a reason he did not bother to dwell on, being perfectly aware what it was, to be in a relationship just now. The pad thai was excellent, their conversation light and amusing. Strike told Lorelei nothing about his new case, except that he hoped it would be both lucrative and interesting. After doing the dishes together, they repaired to the bedroom, with its candy pink walls and its curtains printed with cartoonish cowgirls and ponies. Lorelei liked to dress up. To bed that night, she wore stockings and a black corset. She had the talent, by no means usual, of staging an erotic scene without tipping into parody. Perhaps with his one leg and his broken nose, Strike ought to have felt ludicrous in this boudoir, which was all frivolity and prettiness, but she played Aphrodite to his Hephaestus so adeptly that thoughts of Robin and Matthew were sometimes driven entirely from his mind. There was, after all, little pleasure to compare with that given by a woman who really wanted you, he thought next day at lunchtime, as they sat side by side at a pavement cafe, reading separate papers, Strike smoking, Lorelei's perfectly painted nails trailing absently along the back of his hand. So why had he already told her that he needed to work this afternoon? It was true that he needed to drop off the listening devices at Chisel's Belgravia flat, but he could easily have spent another night with her, returned to the bedroom, the stockings and the basque. The prospect was certainly tempting. Yet something implacable inside him refused to give in. Two nights in a row would break the pattern. From there, it would be a short slide into true intimacy. In the depths of himself, Strike could not imagine a future in which he lived with a woman, married or fathered children. He had planned some of those things with Charlotte, in the days when he had been readjusting to life minus half his leg. An IED on a dusty road in Afghanistan had blasted Strike out of his chosen life into an entirely new body and a new reality. Sometimes he saw his proposal to Charlotte as the most extreme manifestation of his temporary disorientation in the aftermath of his amputation. He had needed to relearn how to walk, and almost as hard, to live a life outside the military. From a distance of 2 years, he saw himself trying to hold tight to some part of his past as everything else slipped away. The allegiance he had given the army, he had transferred to a future with Charlotte.
"Good move," his old friend Dave Polworth had said, without missing a beat, when Strike told him of the engagement.
"Shame to waste all that combat training. Slightly increased risk of getting killed, though, mate." Had he ever really thought the wedding would happen? Had he truly imagined Charlotte settling for the life he could give her? After everything they had been through, had he believed that they could achieve redemption together, each of them damaged in their own untidy, personal, and peculiar ways? It seemed to Strike, sitting in the sunshine with Lorelei, that for a few months he had both believed it wholeheartedly and known that it was impossible, never planning more than a few weeks ahead, holding Charlotte at night as though she were the last human on Earth, as though only Armageddon could separate them. "Want another coffee?" murmured Lorelei.
"I'd better make a move," said Strike.
"When will I see you?" she asked, as Strike paid the waiter.
"Told you, I've got this big new job on," he said. "Timings are going to be a bit unpredictable for a while. I'll call you tomorrow. We'll go out as soon as I can get a clear evening."
"All right," she said, smiling, and added softly, "Kiss me." He did so. She pressed her full lips against his, irresistibly recalling certain highlights of the early morning. They broke apart. Strike grinned, bade her goodbye, and left her sitting in the sun with her newspaper. The Minister for Culture did not invite Strike inside when he opened the door of his house in Ebury Street. Chisel seemed keen, in fact, for the detective to leave as quickly as possible.
After taking the box of listening devices, he muttered,
"Good, right, I'll make sure she gets them,"
and was on the point of closing the door when he suddenly called after Strike,
"What's her name?"
"Benicia Hall," said Strike.
Chisel shut the door, and Strike turned his tired footsteps back along the street of quiet golden townhouses towards the Tube and Denmark Street. His office seemed stark and gloomy after Lorelei's flat. Strike threw open the windows to let in the noise of Denmark Street down below, where music lovers continued to visit the instrument stores and old record shops that Strike feared were doomed by the forthcoming redevelopment. The sound of engines and horns, of conversation and footsteps, of guitar riffs played by would-be purchasers, and the distant bongos of another busker were pleasant to Strike as he settled to work, knowing that he had hours ahead in the computer chair if he were to wrest the bare bones of his target's lives from the internet. If you knew where to search and had time and expertise, the outline of many existences could be unearthed in cyberspace. Ghostly exoskeletons, sometimes partial, sometimes unnervingly complete, of the lives led by their flesh and blood counterparts. Strike had learned many tricks and secrets, become adept ferreting in even the darkest corners of the internet. But often the most innocent social media sites held untold wealth. A minor amount of cross-referencing, all that was necessary to compile detailed private histories that their careless owners had never meant to share with the world. Strike first consulted Google Maps to examine the place where Jimmy and Billy had grown up. Stedder Cottage was evidently too small and insignificant to be named, but Chisel House was clearly marked, a short way outside the village of Woolstone. Strike spent 5 minutes fruitlessly scanning the patches of woodland around Chisel House, noticing a couple of tiny squares that might be estate cottages. "They buried it down in the dell by my dad's house," before resuming his investigation of the older, saner brother. Core had a website where Strike found, sandwiched between lengthy polemics about celebration capitalism and neoliberalism, a useful schedule of protests at which Jimmy was planning to demonstrate or speak, which the detective printed out and added to his file. He then followed a link to the Real Socialist Party website, which was an even busier and more cluttered affair than that of Core. Here he found another lengthy article by Jimmy, arguing for the dissolution of the apartheid state of Israel and the defeat of the Zionist lobby, which had a stranglehold on the Western capitalist establishment. Strike noted that Jasper Chisel was among the Western political elite, listed at the bottom of this article as a publicly declared Zionist. Jimmy's girlfriend, Flick, appeared in a couple of photographs on the Real Socialist website, sporting black hair as she marched against Trident, and blonde shaded to pink as she cheered Jimmy, who was speaking on an open-air stage at a Real Socialist Party rally. Following a link to Flick's Twitter handle, he perused her timeline, which was a strange mixture of the cloying and the vituperative. "I hope you get fucking arse cancer, you Tory cunt," sat directly above a video clip of a kitten sneezing so hard that it fell out of its basket. As far as Strike could tell, neither Jimmy nor Flick owned or ever had owned property, something that he had in common with both of them. He could find no indication online of how they were supporting themselves, unless writing for far-left websites paid better than he had imagined. Jimmy was renting the miserable flat in Charlemont Road from a man called Kasturi Kumar, and while Flick made casual mention on social media of living in Hackney, he could not find an address for her anywhere online. Digging deeper into online records, Strike discovered a James Knight of the correct age who seemed to have cohabited for 5 years with a woman called Dawn Clancy, and upon delving into Dawn's highly informative, emoji-strewn Facebook page, Strike discovered that they had been married. Dawn was a hairdresser who had run a successful business in London before returning to her native Manchester. 13 years older than Jimmy, she seemed to have neither children nor any present-day contact with her ex-husband. However, a comment she had made to a jilted girlfriend's "All Men Are Trash" post caught Strike's eye,
Yeah, he's a shit, but at least he hasn't sued you. I win, again. Intrigued, Strike turned his attention to court records, and after a little digging, found several useful nuggets of information. Jimmy had been charged with a fray twice, once on an anti-capitalism march, once at an anti-Trident protest. But this, Strike had expected. What was far more interesting was to find Jimmy on a list of vexatious litigants on the website of HM Courts and Tribunal Service. Due to a long-standing habit of beginning frivolous legal actions, Knight was now forbidden from starting civil cases in courts without permission. Jimmy had certainly had a good run for his, or the state's, money. Over the past decade, he had brought civil actions against sundry individuals and organizations. The law had taken his side only once, when, in 2007, he had won compensation from Zanet Industries, who were found not to have followed due process when dismissing him. Jimmy had represented himself in court against Zanet, and, presumably elated by his win, had gone on to represent himself in suing several others, among them a garage owner, two neighbours, a journalist he alleged had defamed him, two officers in the Metropolitan Police he claimed had assaulted him, two more employers, and finally, his ex-wife, who he said had harassed him and caused him loss of earnings. In Strike's experience, those who disdain the use of representation in court were either unbalanced or so arrogant that it came to the same thing. Jimmy's litigious history suggested that he was greedy and unprincipled, sharp without being wise. It was always useful to have a handle on a man's vulnerabilities when trying to ferret out his secrets. Strike added the names of all the people Jimmy had tried to sue, plus the current address of his ex-wife, to the file beside him. At close to midnight, Strike retired to his flat for some much-needed sleep, rose early on Sunday, and transferred his attention to Geraint Wynne, remaining hunched at the computer until the light began to fade again, by which time a new cardboard file labelled Chisel sat beside him, fat with miscellaneous but cross-checked information on Chisel's two blackmailers. Stretching and yawning, he became suddenly aware of the noises reaching him through the open windows. The music shops had closed at last, the bongos had ceased, but traffic continued to swish and rumble along Charing Cross Road. Strike heaved himself up, supporting himself on the desk because his remaining ankle was numb after hours in the computer chair, and stooped to look through the inner office window at a tangerine sky spread beyond the rooftops. It was Sunday evening, and in less than 2 hours, England would be playing Italy at the quarter-finals of the European Football Championships in Kiev. One of the few personal indulgences Strike had allowed himself was a subscription to Sky, so that he could watch football. The small portable TV that was all his flat upstairs could comfortably accommodate might not be the ideal medium on which to watch such an important game, but he could not justify a night in a pub, given that he had an early start on Monday, covering Dodgy Dock again, a prospect that gave him little pleasure. He checked his watch. He had time to get a Chinese takeaway before the match, but he still needed to call both Barclay and Robin with instructions for the next few days. As he was on the point of picking up the phone, a musical alert told him that he had received an email. The subject line read, "Missing kids in Oxfordshire." Strike laid his mobile and keys back on the desk and clicked it open. "Strike, this is best I can do on a quick search. Obviously, without exact time frame, it's difficult. Two missing child cases in Oxfordshire, Wiltshire, from the early mid-90s, unresolved as far as I can tell. Suki Lewis, 12, went missing from care October 1992. Also, Imamu Ibrahim, 5-year-old, disappeared 1996. Father disappeared at the same time, is believed to be in Algeria. Without further information, not much to be done. Best, E." Chapter 12. The atmosphere we breathe is heavy with storms. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. The sunset cast a ruddy glow across the duvet behind Robin as she sat at the dressing table in her and Matthew's spacious new bedroom.
Next door's barbecue was now smoking the air that had earlier been fragrant with honeysuckle. She had just left Matthew downstairs, lying on the sofa, watching the warm-up to the England-Italy game, a cold bottle of Peroni in his hand. Opening the dressing table drawer, she took out a pair of coloured contact lenses she had concealed there. After trial and error the previous day, she had decided the hazel ones appeared most natural with her strawberry blonde hair. Gingerly, she extracted first one, then the other, placing them over her watering blue-grey irises. It was essential that she get used to wearing them. Ideally, she would have had them in all weekend, but Matthew's reaction when he had seen her in them had dissuaded her. "Your eyes," he had said, after staring at her, perplexed for a few seconds. "Bloody hell, that looks horrible. Take them out." As Saturday had already been ruined by one of their tense disagreements about her job, she had chosen not to wear the lenses all weekend, because they would serve as a constant reminder to Matthew about what she was up to the following week. He seemed to think that working undercover in the House of Commons was tantamount to treason, and her refusal to tell him who either her client or her targets were had further aggravated him. Robin kept telling herself that Matthew was worried about her safety, and that he could hardly be blamed for it. It had become a mental exercise she performed like a penance. "You can't blame him for being concerned. You nearly got killed last year. He wants you to be safe." However, the fact that she had gone for a drink with Strike on Friday seemed to be worrying Matthew far more than any potential killer. "Don't you think you're being bloody hypocritical?" he said. Whenever he was angry, the skin around his nose and upper lip became taut. Robin had noticed it years ago, but lately it gave her a sensation close to revulsion. She had never mentioned this to her therapist. It had felt too nasty, too visceral. "How am I hypocritical? Going for cozy little drinks with him. Matt, I work with, then complaining when I have lunch with Sarah. Have lunch with her," said Robin, her pulse quickening in anger. "Do it. As a matter of fact, I met her in the Red Lion out with some men from work. Do you want to call Tom and tell him his fiancée's drinking with colleagues, or am I the only one who's not allowed to do it?" The skin around his nose and mouth looked like a muzzle as it tightened, Robin thought. A pale muzzle on a snarling dog. "Would you have told me you'd gone for a drink with him if Sarah hadn't seen you?" "Yes," said Robin, her temper snapping. "And I'd have known you'd be a dick about it, too." The tense aftermath of this argument, by no means their most serious of the last month, had lingered all through Sunday. Only in the last couple of hours, with the prospect of the England game to cheer him, had Matthew become amiable again. Robin had even volunteered to fetch him a Peroni from the kitchen, and kissed him on the forehead before leaving him with a sense of liberation for her coloured contact lenses and her preparations for the following day. Her eyes felt gradually less uncomfortable with repeated blinking. Robin moved across to the bed where her laptop lay. Pulling it towards her, she saw that an email from Strike had just arrived. "Robin, bit of research on the winds attached. I'll call you shortly for quick brief before tomorrow. C.S. Robin was annoyed. Strike was supposed to be plugging gaps and working nights. Did he think she had done no research of her own over the weekend? Nevertheless, she clicked on the first of several attachments, a document summarizing the fruits of Strike's online labor. Geraint Wynne. Geraint Ifon Wynne, D.O.B., 15th of July, 1950, born Cardiff. Father a minor, grammar school educated, met Della at University of Cardiff. Was property consultant prior to acting as her election agent and running her parliamentary office post-election. No details of former career available online. No company ever registered in his name. Lives with Della, Southwark Park Road, Bermondsey. Strike had managed to dig up a couple of poor-quality pictures of Geraint with his well-known wife, both of which Robin had already found and saved to her laptop. She knew how hard Strike had had to work to find an image of Geraint, because it had taken her a long time the previous night, while Matthew slept, to find them. Press photographers did not seem to feel he added much to pictures. A thin, balding man who wore heavy-framed glasses, he had a lipless mouth, a weak chin, and a pronounced overbite, which, taken together, put Robin in mind of an overweight gecko. Strike had also attached information on the Minister for Sport. Della Wynne. D.O.B. 8th of August 1947. Nay Jones. Born and raised Vale of Glamorgan, Wales. Both parents teachers. Blind from birth due to bilateral microphthalmia. Attended St. Enodoc Royal School for the Blind from age 5 to 18. Won multiple swimming awards as teenager. See attached articles for further details, also of the Playing Field charity. Even though Robin had read as much as she could about Della over the weekend, she ploughed diligently through both articles. They told her little that she did not already know. Della had worked for a prominent human rights charity before successfully standing for election in the Welsh constituency in which she had been born. She was a long-time advocate for the benefit of sports in deprived areas, a champion of disabled athletes, and a supporter for projects that used sport to rehabilitate injured veterans. The founding of her charity, the Level Playing Field, to support young athletes and sports people facing challenges, whether of poverty or physical impairment, had received a fair amount of press coverage. Many high-profile sports people had given their time to fundraisers. The articles that Strike had attached both mentioned something that Robin already knew from her own research. The Wynnes, like the Chisels, had lost a child. Della and Geraint's daughter and only offspring had killed herself at the age of 16, a year before Della had stood for Parliament. The tragedy was mentioned in every profile Robin had read on Della Wynne, even those lauding her substantial achievements. Her maiden speech in Parliament had supported a proposed bullying hotline, but she had never otherwise discussed her child's suicide. Robin's mobile rang. After checking that the bedroom door was closed, Robin answered.
"That was quick,"
said Strike thickly, through a mouthful of Singapore noodles.
"Sorry. Took me by surprise. Just got a takeaway."
"I've read your email," said Robin. She heard a metallic snap and was sure he was opening a can of beer. "Very useful, thanks."
"Got your disguise sorted?" Strike asked.
"Yes," said Robin, turning to examine herself at the mirror. It was strange how much a change of eye colour transformed your face. She was planning to wear a pair of clear-lensed glasses over her hazel eyes.
"And you know enough about Chisel to pretend to be his goddaughter?"
"Of course," said Robin.
"Go on, then," said Strike. "Impress me."
"Born 1944, Robin said at once, without reading her notes. "Studied classics at Merton College, Oxford, then joined Queen's Own Hussars, saw active service in Aden and Singapore. First wife, Lady Patricia Fleetwood, 3 children, Sophia, Isabella and Freddie. Sophia's married and lives in Northumberland. Isabella runs Chisel's parliamentary office."
"Does she?" said Strike, sounding vaguely surprised, and Robin was pleased to know that she had discovered something he did not.
"Is she the daughter you knew?" she asked, remembering what Strike had said in the office.
"Wouldn't go as far as new. I met her a couple of times with Charlotte. Everyone called her Izzy Chizzy, one of those upper-class nicknames."
"Lady Patricia divorced Chisel after he got a political journalist pregnant, which resulted in a disappointing son at the art gallery."
"Exactly." Robin moved the mouse around to bring up a saved picture, this time of a dark and rather beautiful young man in a charcoal suit, heading up courtroom steps, accompanied by a stylish black-haired woman in sunglasses, whom he closely resembled, though she looked hardly old enough to be his mother.
"But Chisel and the journalist split up not long after Raphael was born," said Robin.
"The family calls him Raph," said Strike, "and the second wife doesn't like him. Thinks Chisel should have disowned him after the car crash."
Robin made a further note.
"Great, thanks. Chisel's current wife, Kinvara, was unwell last year," Robin continued, bringing up a picture of Kinvara, a curvaceous redhead in a slinky black dress and heavy diamond necklace. She was some 30 years younger than Chisel and pouting at the camera. Had she not known, Robin would have guessed them father and daughter rather than a married couple.
"With nervous exhaustion," said Strike, beating her to it.
"Yeah, Drink or drugs, do you reckon?
Robin heard a clang and surmised that Strike had just dropped an empty tenant's can in the office bin. He was alone then. Lorelei never stayed in the tiny flat upstairs.
Who knows? Said Robin,
her eyes still on Kinvara Chisel.
One last thing, said Strike. Just in. A couple of kids went missing in Oxfordshire around the right time to tally with Billy's story.
There was a brief pause.
You still there? Asked Strike.
Yes. I thought you didn't believe Chisel strangled a child.
I don't, said Strike. The timescale doesn't fit, and if Jimmy knew a Tory minister had strangled a kid, he wouldn't have waited 20 years to try and monetize it. But I'd still like to know whether Billy's imagining that he saw someone throttled. I'm going to do a bit of digging on the names Wardle's given me, and if either seem credible, I might ask you to sound Lizzie out. She might remember something about a kid disappearing in the vicinity of Chisel House.
Robin said nothing.
Like I said in the pub, Billy's very ill. It's probably nothing, said Strike, with a trace of defensiveness.
As he and Robin were both well aware, he had previously jettisoned paid cases and rich clients to pursue mysteries that others might have let lie.
I just
can't rest until you've looked into it, said Robin. All right, I understand.
Unseen by her, Strike grinned and rubbed his tired eyes.
Well, best of luck tomorrow, he said. I'll be on my mobile if you need me.
What are you going to be up to?
Paperwork. Jimmy Knight's ex doesn't work Mondays. I'm off to Manchester to find her on Tuesday.
Robin experienced a sudden wave of nostalgia for the previous year, when she and Strike had undertaken a road trip together to interrogate women left behind in the wake of dangerous men. She wondered whether he had thought about it while he planned this journey.
Watching England, Italy? She asked.
Yes, said Strike. There's nothing else, is there?
No,
said Robin hurriedly. She had not meant to sound as though she wanted to detain him.
Speak soon, then.
She cut the call on his farewell and tossed the mobile aside onto the bed. Chapter 13 I am not going to let myself be beaten to the ground by the dread of what may happen. Henry Gibson, Rosmersholm. The following morning Robin woke, gasping, her fingers at her own throat, trying to loosen a non-existent hold. She was already at the bedroom door when Matthew woke, confused.
It's nothing, I'm fine, she muttered,
before he could articulate a question, groping to find the handle that would let her out of the bedroom. The surprise was that it hadn't happened more often since she had heard the story of the strangled child. Robin knew exactly how it felt to have fingers closed tightly around your neck, to feel your brain flood with darkness, to know that you were seconds from being blotted out of existence. She had been driven into therapy by sharp-edged fragments of recollection that were unlike normal memories, and which had the power to drag her suddenly out of her body and plunge her back into a past where she could smell the strangler's nicotine-stained fingers and feel the stabber's soft, sweatshirted belly against her back. She locked the bathroom door and sat down on the floor in the loose T-shirt she had worn to bed, focusing on her breathing, on the feel of the cool tiles beneath her bare legs, observing, as she had been taught, the rapid beating of her heart, the adrenaline jolting through her veins, not fighting her panic, but watching it. After a while, she consciously noticed the faint smell of the lavender body wash she had used last night, and heard the distant passing of an aeroplane.
You're safe. Just a dream. Just a dream.
Through two closed doors, she heard Matthew's alarm go off. A few minutes later, he knocked on the door.
You all right?
Fine,
Robin called back over the running tap. She opened the door.
Everything okay?
He asked, watching her closely.
Just needed a pee,
said Robin brightly, heading back to the bedroom for her coloured contact lenses. Before starting work with Strike, Robin had signed on with an agency called Temporary Solutions. The offices to which they had sent her were jumbled in her memory now, so that only anomalies, eccentrics and oddities remained. She remembered the alcoholic boss whose dictated letters she had reworded out of kindness. The desk drawer she had opened to find a complete set of dentures and a pair of stained underpants. The hopeful young man who had nicknamed her Bobby and tried, ineptly, to flirt over their back-to-back monitors. The woman who had plastered the interior of her cubicle workspace with pictures of the actor Ian McShane, and the girl who had broken up with her boyfriend on the telephone in the middle of the open-plan office, indifferent to the purient hush falling over the rest of the room. Robin doubted whether any of the people with whom she had come into glancing contact remembered her any better than she remembered them, even the timid romancer who had called her Bobby. However, from the moment that she arrived at the Palace of Westminster, she knew that what happened here would live in her memory for ever. She felt a ripple of pleasure simply to leave the tourists behind and pass through the gate where the policeman stood guard. As she approached the palace, with its intricate gold mouldings starkly shadowed in the early morning sun, the famous clock tower silhouetted against the sky, her nerves and her excitement mounted. Stryker told her which side door to use. It led into a long, dimly lit stone hall, but first she must pass through a metal detector and X-ray machine, of the kind used at airports. As she took off her shoulder bag to be scanned, Robin noticed a tall, slightly disheveled natural blonde in her 30s waiting a short distance away, holding a small package wrapped in brown paper. The woman watched as Robin stood for an automated picture that would appear on a paper day pass, to be worn on a lanyard around her neck, and when the security man waved Robin on, stepped forwards.
"Venetia?"
"Yes," said Robin.
"Izzy,"
said the other, smiling and holding out a hand. She was wearing a loose blouse with a splashy pattern of oversized flowers on it, and wide-legged trousers.
"This is from Papa."
She pressed the package she was holding into Robin's hands.
"I'm really sorry. We've got to dash. So glad you got here on time."
She set off at a brisk walk, and Robin hastened to follow.
"I'm in the middle of printing off a bunch of papers to take over to Papa at DCMS. I'm snowed under just now. Papa being Minister for Culture, with the Olympics coming, it's just crazy."
She led Robin at a near jog through the hall, which had stained glass windows at the far end, and off along labyrinthine corridors, talking all the while in a confident upper-class accent, leaving Robin impressed by her lung power.
"Yeah, I'm leaving at the summer recess, setting up a decorating company with my friend Jax. I've been here for 5 years. Papa's not happy. He needs somebody really good, and the only applicant he liked turned us down."
She talked over her shoulder at Robin, who was hurrying to keep up.
"I don't suppose you know any fabulous PAs?"
"I'm afraid not," said Robin,
who had retained no friends from her temping career.
"Nearly there," said Izzy,
who had led Robin through a bewildering number of narrow corridors, all carpeted in the same forest green as the leather seats Robin had seen in the Commons on TV. At last, they reached a side passage, off which led several heavy wooden doors, arched in the Gothic style.
"That,"
said Izzy in a stage whisper, pointing as they passed the first door on the right,
"is Wynne's. This," she said,
marching to the last door on the left,
"is ours."
She stood aside to let Robin pass into the room first. The office was cramped and cluttered. The arched stone windows were hung with net curtains, beyond which lay the terrace bar, where shadowy figures moved against the dazzling brightness of the Thames. There were two desks, a multitude of bookshelves, and a sagging green armchair. Green drapes hung at the overflowing bookshelves that covered one wall, only partially concealing the untidy stacks of files stacked there. On top of a filing cabinet stood a TV monitor, showing the currently empty interior of the Commons, its green benches deserted. A kettle sat beside mismatched mugs on a low shelf and had stained the wallpaper above it. The desktop printer whirred wheezily in the corner. Some of the papers it was disgorging had slid onto the threadbare carpet.
"Oh, shit,"
said Izzy, dashing over and scooping them up, while Robin closed the door behind her.
As she tapped the fallen papers back into a neat stack on her desk, Izzy said,
"I'm thrilled Papa's brought you in. He's been under so much strain, which he really doesn't need with everything we've got on now. But you and Strike will sort it out, won't you?"
"Wynne's a horrible little man," said Izzy, reaching for a leather folder. "Inadequate, you know."
"How long have you worked with Strike?"
"A couple of years," said Robin, as she undid the package Izzy had given her.
"I've met him. Did he tell you?"
"Yeah.
I was at school with his ex, Charlie Campbell. Gorgeous, but troubled, Charlie. Do you know her?"
"No," said Robin. A long ago near collision outside Strike's office had been her only contact with Charlotte.
"I always quite fancied Strike," said Izzy.
Robin glanced around, surprised, but Izzy was matter-of-factly inserting papers into the folder.
"Yeah, people couldn't see it, but I could. He was so butch and so, well, unapologetic."
"Unapologetic?" Robin repeated.
"Yeah, he never took crap from anyone. Didn't give a toss that people thought he wasn't, you know,
good enough for her." As soon as the words escaped her, Robin felt embarrassed. She had felt suddenly strangely protective of Strike. It was absurd, of course. If anybody could look after themselves, it was he.
"Suppose so," said Izzy, still waiting for her papers to print. "It's been ghastly for Papa these past couple of months, and it isn't as though what he did was wrong," she said fiercely. "One minute is legal, the next it isn't. That's not Papa's fault."
"What wasn't legal?" asked Robin innocently.
"Sorry," Izzy replied, pleasantly but firmly. "Papa says the fewer people know, the better."
She peeked through the net curtains at the sky.
"I won't need a jacket, will I? No. Sorry to dash, but Papa needs these and he's off to meet Olympic sponsors at 10. Good luck."
And in a rush of flowered fabric and tousled hair, she was gone, leaving Robin curious but strangely reassured. If Izzy could take this robust view of her father's misdemeanour, it surely could not be anything dreadful, always assuming, of course, that Chisel had told his daughter the truth. Robin ripped the last piece of wrapping from the small parcel Izzy had given her. It contained, as she had known it would, the half-dozen listening devices that Strike had given to Jasper Chisel over the weekend. As a minister of the Crown, Chisel was not required to pass through the security scanner every morning as Robin was. She examined the bugs carefully. They had the appearance of normal plastic PowerPoints and were designed to be fitted over genuine plug sockets, allowing the latter to function as normal. They would begin to record only when somebody spoke in their vicinity. She could hear her own heartbeat in the silence left by Izzy's departure. The difficulty of her task was only just beginning to sink in. She took off her coat, hung it up, then removed from her shoulder bag a large box of Tampax, which she had brought for the purpose of concealing the listening devices she wasn't using. After hiding all but one of the bugs inside it, she placed the box in the bottom drawer of her desk. Next, she searched the cluttered shelves until she found an empty box file in which she hid the remaining device beneath a handful of letters with typos that she took out of a pile labelled "For Shredding." Thus armed, Robin took a deep breath and left the room. Wynne's door had opened since she had arrived. As Robin walked past, she saw a tall young Asian man wearing thick-lensed glasses and carrying a kettle.
"Hi,"
said Robin at once, imitating Izzy's bold, cheery approach.
"I'm Venetia Hall. We're neighbours. Who are you?"
"Amir," muttered the other, in a working-class London accent. "Malik."
"Do you work for Della Wynne?"
asked Robin. "Yeah."
"Oh, she's so inspirational," gushed Robin. "One of my heroines, actually."
Amir did not reply, but radiated a desire to be left alone. Robin felt like a terrier trying to harass a racehorse.
"Have you worked here long?"
"6 months."
"Are you going to the cafe?"
"No," said Amir, as though she had propositioned him, and he turned sharply away towards the bathroom. Robin walked on, holding her box file, wondering whether she had imagined animosity rather than shyness in the young man's demeanour. It would have been helpful to make a friend in Wynne's office. Having to pretend to be an Izzy-esque goddaughter of Jasper Chisel was hampering her.
She couldn't help but feel that Robin Ellicott from Yorkshire might have befriended Amir more easily. Having set off with fake purpose, she decided to explore for a while before returning to Izzy's office. Chisels and Wynne's offices were in the Palace of Westminster itself, which, with its vaulted ceilings, libraries, tea rooms and air of comfortable grandeur, might have been an old university college. A half-uncovered passageway, watched over by large stone statues of a unicorn and lion, led to an escalator to Portcullis House. This was a modern crystal palace, with a folded glass roof, triangular panes held in place by thick black struts. Beneath was a wide open-plan area including a café, where MPs and civil servants mingled. Flanked by full-grown trees, large water features consisting of long blocks of covered-in shallow pools became dazzling strips of quicksilver in the June sunshine. There was a shiver of ambition in the thrumming air, and the sense of being part of a vital world. Beneath a ceiling of artfully fragmented glass, Robin passed political journalists perched on leather benches, all of whom were checking or talking on their mobiles, typing onto laptops, or intercepting politicians for comment. Robin wondered whether she might have enjoyed working here if she had never been sent to strike. Her explorations ended in the third, dingiest, and least interesting of the buildings that housed MPs' offices, which resembled nothing so much as a three-star hotel with worn carpets and cream walls and row upon row of identical doors. Robin doubled back, still clutching her file, and passed Wynne's door again 50 minutes after she had last seen it. Quickly checking that the corridor was deserted, she pressed her ear against the thick oak and thought she heard movement within.
"How's it going?"
asked Izzy, when Robin re-entered her office a couple of minutes later.
"I haven't seen Wynne yet. He might be over at DCMS. He goes to see Della on any excuse," said Izzy. "Fancy a coffee?"
But before she could leave her desk, her telephone rang. While Izzy fielded a call from an irate constituent who had been unable to secure tickets for the Olympic diving,
"Yes, I like Tom Daly too," she said, rolling her eyes at Robin. "But it's a lottery, madam."
Robin spooned out instant coffee and poured UHT milk, wondering how many times she had done this in offices she hated, and feeling suddenly extraordinarily grateful that she had escaped that life forever.
"Hung up,"
said Lizzie indifferently, setting down the receiver.
"What were we talking about? Oh, Geraint, yeah. He's furious Della didn't make him a spad."
"What's a spad?" Robin asked, setting Izzy's coffee down and taking a seat at the other desk.
"Special advisor. They're like temporary civil servants. Lots more prestige. But you don't hand the posts out to family, it's not done. Anyway, Geraint's hopeless. She wouldn't want him, even if it were possible."
"I just met the man who works with Wynne," said Robin. "Amir. He wasn't too friendly."
"Oh, he's odd," said Izzy dismissively. "Barely civil to me. It's probably because Geraint and Della hate Papa. I've never really got to the bottom of why, but they seem to hate all of us. Oh, that reminds me. Papa texted a minute ago. My brother Raff's going to be coming in later this week to help out in here. Maybe," Izzy added, though she did not sound particularly hopeful, "if Raff's any good, he might be able to take over from me. But Raff doesn't know anything about the blackmail or who you really are, so don't say anything, will you? Papa's got about 14 godchildren. Raff'll never know the difference."
Izzy sipped her coffee again. Then, suddenly subdued, she said,
"I suppose you know about Raff. It was all over the papers. That poor woman. It was awful. She had a 4-year-old daughter."
"I did see something," said Robin, non-committally.
"I was the only one in the family who visited him in jail," said Izzy. "Everyone was so disgusted by what he'd done. Kinvara, Papa's wife, said he should have got life, but she's got no idea," she continued. "How ghastly it was in there. People don't realise what prison's like. I mean, I know he did a terrible thing, but..."
Her words trailed away. Robin wondered, perhaps ungenerously, whether Izzy was suggesting that jail was no place for a young man as refined as her half-brother. Doubtless it had been a horrible experience, Robin thought, but after all, he had taken drugs, climbed into a car,
and mown down a young mother. "I thought he was working in an art gallery," Robin asked.
"He's gone and messed up at Drummond's," sighed Izzy. "Papa's really taking him in to keep an eye on him."
Public money paid for these salaries, Robin thought, remembering again the unusually short prison sentence the son of the minister had served for that drug-induced fatal accident.
"How did he mess up at the gallery?"
To her great surprise, Izzy's doleful expression vanished in a sudden spurt of laughter.
"Oh, God, I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh. He shagged the other sales assistant in the loo," she said, quaking with giggles. "I know it isn't funny, really, but he just got out of jail and Raff's lovely-looking and he's always pulled anyone he wants. They shoved him into a suit and put him in close proximity with some pretty little blonde art graduate. What did they think was going to happen? But as you can imagine, the gallery owner wasn't too chuffed. He heard them going at it and put Raff on a final warning. Then Raff and the girl went and did it again. So Papa had a total fit and says he's coming here instead."
Robin didn't feel particularly amused, but Izzy appeared not to notice, lost in her own thoughts.
"You never know, it could be the making of them, Papa and Raff," she said hopefully, then checked her watch. "Better return some calls," she sighed, setting down her coffee mug. But as she reached for her phone, she froze, fingers on the receiver, as a sing-song male voice rang out in the corridor beyond the closed door.
"That's him, Wynne."
"Well, here I go," said Robin, snatching up her box file again.
"Good luck,"
whispered Izzy.
Emerging into the corridor, Robin saw Wynne standing in the doorway of his office, apparently talking to Amir, who was inside. Wynne was holding a folder with orange lettering on it saying, "The Level Playing Field." At the sound of Robin's footsteps, he turned to face her.
"Well, hello there,"
he said with a Cardiff lilt, stepping back into the corridor. His gaze dribbled down Robin's neck, fell onto her breasts, then up again to her mouth and eyes. Robin knew him from that single look. She had met plenty of them in offices, the type who watched you in a way that made you feel clumsy and self-conscious, who would place a hand in the small of the back as they sidled behind you or ushered you through doors, who peered over your shoulder on the excuse of reading your monitor and made chancy little comments on your clothes that progressed to comments on your figure during after-work drinks. They cried, "Joke!" if you got angry, and became aggressive in the face of complaints.
"Where do you fit in, then?" asked Geraint, making the question sound salacious.
"I'm interning for Uncle Jasper," said Robin, smiling brightly.
"Uncle Jasper?"
"Jasper Chisel, yes," said Robin, pronouncing the name as the Chiswells did themselves. "Chisel. He's my godfather, Venetia Hall," said Robin, holding out her hand. Everything about Wynne seemed faintly amphibian, down to his damp palm. He was less like a gecko in the flesh, she thought, and more like a frog, with a pronounced pot belly and spindly arms and legs, his thinning hair rather greasy.
"And how did it come about that you are Jasper's goddaughter?"
"Oh, Uncle Jasper and Daddy are all friends," said Robin, who had a full backstory prepared.
"Army?"
"Land management," said Robin, sticking to her prearranged story.
"Ah," said Geraint. Then, "Lovely hair. Is it natural?"
"Yes," said Robin. His eyes slid down her body again. It cost Robin an effort to keep smiling at him. At last, gushing and giggling until her cheek muscles ached, agreeing that she would indeed give him a shout should he need any assistance, Robin walked on down the corridor. She could feel him watching her until she turned out of sight. Just as Strike had felt after discovering Jimmy Knight's litigious habits, Robin was sure that she had just gained a valuable insight into Wynne's weakness. In her experience, men like Geraint were astoundingly prone to believe that their scattergun sexual advances were appreciated and even reciprocated. She had spent no inconsiderable part of her temping career trying to rebuff and avoid such men, all of whom saw lubricious invitations in the merest pleasantry, and for whom youth and inexperience were an irresistible temptation.
How far, she asked herself, was she prepared to go in her quest to find out things to Wynne's discredit? Walking with sham purpose through endless corridors to support her pretense of having papers to deliver, Robin pictured herself leaning over his desk while the inconvenient Emir was elsewhere, breasts at eye level, asking for help and advice, giggling at smutty jokes. Then, with a sudden dreadful lurch of imagination, she saw clearly Wynne's lunge, saw the sweaty face swooping for her, its lipless mouth agape, felt hands gripping her arms, pinning them to her sides, felt the pot belly press itself into her, squashing her backwards into a filing cabinet. The endless green of carpet and chairs, the dark wood arches and the square panels seemed to blur and contract as Wynne's imagined pass became an attack. She pushed through the door ahead as though she could physically force herself past her panic.
Breathe. Breathe. Breathe.
Bit overwhelming the first time you see it, eh?
The man sounded kindly and not very young.
Yes,
said Robin, barely knowing what she said.
Breathe.
Temporary, eh?
And then,
you all right, dear?
Asthma, said Robin.
She had used the excuse before. It gave her an excuse to stop, to breathe deeply, to re-anchor herself to reality.
Got an inhaler?
Asked the elderly steward in concern. He wore a frock coat, white tie and tails, and an ornate badge of office. In his unexpected grandeur, Robin thought wildly of the white rabbit popping up in the middle of madness.
I left it in my office. I'll be fine. Just need a second.
She had blundered into a blaze of golden colour that was increasingly her feeling of oppression. The members' lobby, that familiar, ornate, Victorian Gothic chamber that she had seen on television, stood right outside the Commons, and on the periphery of her vision loomed four gigantic bronze statues of previous prime ministers, Thatcher, Attlee, Lloyd George, and Churchill, while busts of all the others lined the walls. They appeared to Robin like severed heads, and the gilding, with its intricate tracery and richly coloured embellishments, danced around her, jeering at her inability to cope with its ornate beauty. She heard the scraping of a chair's legs. The steward had brought her a seat and was asking a colleague to fetch a glass of water.
Thank you. Thank you,
said Robin numbly, feeling inadequate, ashamed, and embarrassed. Strike must never know about this. He would send her home, tell her she wasn't fit to do the job. Nor must she tell Matthew, who treated these episodes as shameful, inevitable consequences of her stupidity in continuing surveillance work. The steward talked to her kindly while she recovered, and within a few minutes she was able to respond appropriately to his well-intentioned patter. While her breathing returned to normal, he told her the tale of how Edward Heath's bust had begun to turn green on the arrival of the full-sized Thatcher statue beside him, and how it had had to be treated to turn it back to its dark brown bronze. Robin laughed politely, got to her feet, and handed him the empty glass with renewed thanks. What treatment would it take, she wondered as she set off again, to return her to what she had once been? Chapter 14. How happy I should feel if I could succeed in bringing a little light into all this murky ugliness. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Strike rose early on Tuesday morning. After showering, putting on his prosthesis and dressing, he filled a thermos with dark brown tea, took the sandwiches he had made the previous evening out of the fridge, stowed them in a carrier bag, along with two packets of club biscuits, chewing gum, and a few bags of salt and vinegar crisps, then headed out into the sunrise and off to the garage where he kept his BMW. He had an appointment for a haircut at 12:30 with Jimmy Knight's ex-wife in Manchester. Once settled in the car, his bag of provisions within easy reach, Strike pulled on the trainers he kept in the car, which gave his fake foot better purchase on the brake. He then took out his mobile and began to compose a text to Robin. Starting with the names that Wardle had given him, Strike had spent much of Monday researching, as best